Kathy Miller, professor of medicine at the Indiana University School of Medicine in Indianapolis. Welcome to Medscape Oncology Insights, coming to you from the 2017 annual meeting of the American Society of Clinical Oncology. As oncologists, we all want to give our patients the best treatment available. But with some patients, especially our older patients, we often give them more treatment than they really need. Here to talk about the issue of overtreating elderly breast cancer patients is Dr. Reshma Jagsi. Reshma is professor and deputy chair of radiation oncology at the University of Michigan. She's also contributed to the NCCN guidelines on older adult oncology. Welcome, Reshma.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Kathy.
So we use radiation in several different ways in breast cancer. Certainly after breast conserving surgery, more commonly after mastectomy, mm-hmm. and in the palliative setting of mm-hmm. metastatic disease. Where do you see overtreatment having the biggest issue?
So I think the biggest issue in terms of overtreatment really lies in the adjuvant setting after breast-conserving surgery. And that's because we have now high-quality evidence from not only CALGB9343, but also now early results from the PRIME2 randomized controlled trial, both of which have demonstrated that in select women who are older and have biologically favorable disease, we may be able to get away with less treatment if this is something that patients would prefer.
So I have to ask you about some keywords you put in there.
Yes.
So select patients. Mm-hmm. How do we select them?
So on those trials, the women were in the CALGB trial 70 years of age and older, on the PRIME2 study 65 and older. So these results shouldn't be generalized to patients much younger than that. But they're patients with early stage disease, stage 1 disease, tumors that are 2 centimeters or smaller that haven't spread to the lymph nodes, at least based on clinical examination. I think an important point that often gets missed is that people don't realize that more than 60% of the patients on the CALGB trial actually had only clinical staging their axilla. And so we assume that patients must have pathologic staging if they are to be eligible to omit radiotherapy, and that's not the case. And those trials included patients who had estrogen receptor-sensitive disease and women who were intending to and willing to receive endocrine therapy.
So that's still a really large group of women. I think you just described one of the most common mm-hmm. group of new breast cancer patients that we see.
Absolutely.
The CALGB data in particular, it's been over a decade mm-hmm. that we've had that data. What impact has that data had on practice?
So it's been a decade since we've had the early 5-year data from the CALGB trial, which showed that the women who had radiation therapy after breast conserving surgery and went on to receive tamoxifen had a risk of only 1% at 5 years of local regional breast tumor recurrence, and the risk was 4% in the women who didn't have radiation therapy. So it was different, but it was a small difference, and the 4% was considered by many to be acceptable. But that was 5-year data. We didn't have the 10-year data until somewhat more recently, but you're right, it has been years now since we've had the 10-year data. And unfortunately, practice pattern studies have not shown much of a decrease in the utilization of radiotherapy in those patients.
So just to be clear for our listeners, we do now have the 10-year data. Mm-hmm. What did that look like? Because that is an issue for local recurrence.
Absolutely. And so there was a significant difference between receiving radiotherapy and not receiving radiotherapy. But the absolute risks were low enough that this presents a reasonable option for women to consider whether or not to have radiation treatment. So the risk was 10% without radiotherapy, and that was reduced to 2% with radiation therapy. And so it certainly remains quite reasonable and quite important to offer these patients radiation therapy as an option. But what's wonderful about these data is that we can now allow women to make individualized preference concordant, value concordant decisions, right? The decision that's right for them, which is what we all strive to do for our patients.
So how do we know what's right for them? And more importantly, how do we know what the discussions and the decisions are? And we can get data about who does or does not mm-hmm. get radiation. We can see if the proportion of women in those groups is getting radiation mm-hmm. changes.
Right.
how do we know when we've gotten it right, that we're at the right proportion?
It's a real challenge. And so we absolutely can't just look at the rate of utilization alone, because the right rate of utilization shouldn't be 100% and it shouldn't be 0%. It should be somewhere in between there. But in order to understand if we've gotten it right, we really do need to understand what's going on in the exam room. So I have the great privilege of working with a research team, the CANSORT research team, that actually takes population-based samples of patients diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer and asks them what they were told, how they decided, and then also surveys the physicians who've been caring for these patients and asks them their impression of the data, what they offer to patients. And the insights that have emerged from the type of research we've done in older adult patients in these settings have been that many women are not offered the option of omitting radiotherapy. Many surgeons and radiation oncologists tell us that they believe it's unreasonable to offer omission of radiotherapy. We've done a very good job as a radiation oncology community in educating everyone about the importance of radiation therapy as an adjuvant to breast-conserving surgery in general. But with these newer data, we need to pull that back just a little bit, while not robbing the many women who definitely benefit from radiation therapy from their radiation therapy. We need to make sure that those who can reasonably consider omission are actually given that option.
So when you say the surgeons and the radiation oncologists thought that it would be wrong to not offer radiation, what do we know about those practitioners? Are they aware of the data? And is this just an issue of, in their mind, 10% is too high? Or is this just an issue of not being aware of the study, not knowing the data?
So it's a little bit of both. So there's a wonderful presentation that will be made at this meeting by a faculty colleague of mine, Dean Shumway, and it will actually report the results of a very large national survey that investigated exactly that question. And what it will demonstrate is that about 40% of the surgeons and 20% of the radiation oncologists think that it's unreasonable. 30% of the surgeons think that radiation therapy actually affords a survival benefit, which was not demonstrated in the CLGB study. 10% of the radiation oncologists think that there's a survival benefit. And many of these individuals do overestimate the benefit of radiotherapy in terms of reducing local regional recurrence risk. In addition, many of these providers were unable to accurately estimate life expectancy. And so we found that those who were less able to estimate life expectancy and less aware of the results of the randomized trials were less likely to view omission of radiation as a reasonable option. And so it's a little bit of both things.
So what did you hear from the patients? I mean, I assume many of those women had radiation. You're now asking them about those decisions and what they heard. Many of them may have heard for the first time as part of that study, maybe I didn't need radiation, or at least maybe it should have been a longer discussion.
So we didn't frame it in a way that, so because our sample includes not just older patients but younger patients, we just asked them, if they didn't receive radiation, why not? And we asked them what they were offered. Were they offered short courses of radiation? Were they offered omission of radiation? So we didn't put them in the position of, hopefully not in the position of second-guessing their decision-making. But I think that it is a very challenging discussion. It is easy to walk into a room and say to a patient, I have something that's going to help you. It's going to be minimal in terms of morbidity. We can get it done relatively efficiently. And gosh, let's get going. It is much more challenging to do the complex risk communication that is involved in sharing what a 10% versus a 2% local recurrence risk really means, right? What does local recurrence mean? What, you know, should we frame it as 10% and 2%, or should we frame it as 98% and 90%? There's some wonderful work going on at my institution where decision scientists are looking at the best ways to frame this information in terms of pictographs, where you see shaded numbers of bodies that actually give you a sense of, with treatment A, with treatment B, the difference.
So even thinking about how you frame it, though, becomes a bit of a minefield, because you may get quite different proportions of patients who would make different choices based on how you frame it and how you present exactly the same numbers.
Yes.
How are you going to know which one's better?
So I think that we need to frame things multiple ways because we know that framing matters. And so the best that we can do to try to fully inform our patients is to give them both valences and to try to fight against this instinct that both doctors and patients have towards overtreatment. We have anticipatory regret. We worry about what we will later be sorry we didn't do. We are risk averse by nature. So we need to recognize those issues. We need to fully inform our patients, give them time to deliberate over this, remove that sense of pressure, and really contribute to the quality of the decision making by providing tools to patients that actually remove some of that heterogeneity in what they hear by actually having standardized language and information that is presented, again, framed one way, framed another way, and repeated, that they can refer back to, reflect upon, and then really deliberate over to come to the right decision.
So I'm thinking about a busy radiation oncologist in the community. Mm-hmm. I think you just described a 2-hour initial consultation mm-hmm. and at least another hour for a second visit mm-hmm. to go through all of this information in detail with multiple ways right. and to get a sense of this patient's values and where she might fall on that spectrum.
And so
that just doesn't seem possible.
Right. And so I agree with you. And so that doesn't seem realistic. And so that's where there is this tremendous power of decision tools. So a colleague of mine, Sarah Hawley, will be presenting at this meeting a randomized interactive decision tool. And the randomization was between static information from high quality sources like ASCO versus an interactive tool that actually engaged patients in telling the tool what their preferences were, and then fed back tailored content. And it's quite exciting what we can do with these types of decision tools, and I think that developing content specific to decisions like this will be the important next step in that research.
It also seems like the sort of research that could apply to a lot of the more complex decisions that we make. You've been looking at overtreatment in this one mm-hmm. situation, but there are a lot of treatment decisions that we make where the differences between very different therapies mm-hmm. are quite small.
Absolutely.
But differences in toxicity and cost may be quite substantial.
Exactly.
Those seem like other settings that we deal with commonly, probably mm-hmm. with some of the same problems.
Exactly. Absolutely. Completely agree.
Well, I think we'll be hearing a lot more about decision science and how we can use the technology to help us with some of these discussions. Thank you, Reshma. And to you, our listeners, thank you for joining us today. This is Dr. Kathy Miller reporting from ASCO 2017.